This is Pam Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Joy Bracey for the first time. And welcome to the Pam Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, let people know we are a featured podcast on the Newsly Network. You can see that little icon up there. It says listen on Newsly. For those of you who haven't tried that out, if you use the coupon code of Ghost, you can check that out for 30 days, no cost. We will be on Newsly later today because we are a featured podcast on that program. That is audio only. This is a video podcast, but that's an audio only version that you can check out. We also have your podcast, your Apple podcast link up for the easy way out. And that's your podcast, right?
Yes, it is.
So that will be fully clickable. So you don't have to worry about remembering that link. But that link will be clicked through everywhere that we're published. So you'll be able to get to that. And today we're going to talk about this topic of treating obesity with modern medicine, a success story using multiple tools, but also tell your story. And one of the first things we always ask any guest on the program is two things we ask is like, what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
Ah, okay. So I am totally motivated by love. I just, when I was a little kid, people would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would say, I don't know, but I want to help people. So I'm definitely motivated by helping others. And that makes me feel good and valuable as a human. And that's why I do what I do also.
That's cool. So what made you interested in accomplishing the goal of, getting people to lose weight and treating obesity? What's the kind of story behind that story?
Well, it started with the fact that, so I'm a teacher by nature and I'm a CEO in an addiction recovery treatment center. And I am a professor. I teach at Teachers College, Columbia University. I teach self-awareness to master's degree students. And I learn by teaching. I teach self-love and self-healing and self-awareness online in my video content. And when I started to go down this road of my self-love journey, I learned early on that being honest with myself was one of the key components of implementing self-love in my life. And, I was at the time 337 pounds, and I had been obese my entire adult life, and my relationship with food was messed up before I could even eat food, because as a little child, my baby teeth were black. They were rotten from being the bottle being left in my mouth all the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I believe that kickstarted the genetics that I had for obesity. And so even before I was an athletic child, so obesity didn't really strike until I hit adulthood. But anyway, so I had spent all of this time like this, and I had lost weight so many times and gained it back, and I had sworn it off. I just did body positivity, and I was like, I'm just going to be in a larger body. I'm going to love my body the way it is. I'm going to embrace my curves, and that's it. I'm just going to be fat forever and love it, and I really embrace that. But then aging started to happen, and self-love and self-honesty. And I started letting myself get real about the consequences of being over 300 pounds and allowing myself to face like what health consequences I was, risking and the price that I was paying, the ways that being 337 was limiting my life. And it was major ways and major price I was paying. It was a huge step. And so I knew that I had to figure it out once and for all, how to lose weight and keep it off. And I knew that it would help me to be teaching other people.
Yeah.
So I said, you know what, if I'm going to dive in and speak with obesity medicine experts, dive in with my family and friends and with therapists about the emotional aspects of why I was holding on to that weight, why I gained weight in the first place, then I'm going to share it. And my goal really isn't for other people to lose weight. My goal is for people with obesity to hear their story in mind, to say, yes, I've lost 80 pounds, 20 pounds, 100 pounds, whatever, and gained it back. and to let go of the shame around that because of everything I've learned about how obesity works, how it's treated, and then all of the emotional stuff that happened that formed in our brains before we were old enough to really make any mature decisions. It's not our fault. But it is treatable. You know, I was 337 pounds wearing a size 28, and now I'm 157 pounds wearing a size 6. And I exercise all the time, and I am not driven crazy by thoughts about food 24/7. It is possible to recover, and I just want to spread the word. I want to talk about it because people have just been told over and over, eat less, move more. It's about willpower. You white knuckle it, and it just doesn't work. Yeah. 95% of people with obesity who lose a significant amount of weight gain it back. And most of the weight is gained back. We're talking about like they're able to keep off a percentage of that, those 5%. So really nobody without medical intervention is losing all of their weight and keeping it off over 5 years. So how do we do it? How do we do it?
It seems like it's a holistic approach because sometimes people look at one leg, they look at dieting, look at nutrition. But if you don't, like I was talking one time to a life coach that was like a physical life coach. Mm-hmm. And he had 6-pack abs and he had perfect like human specimen. But he said his mental state, he did not see himself in the mirror the way he looked. Mm-hmm. And that was causing all kinds of problems with his health outside of the way he physically outside looked perfect. Mm-hmm. But so I think a lot of times it's the kind of looking glass self. From a poet or musicians or artistic standpoint, that's really critical. Like if you don't have good self-worth, if you don't have self-love, if you don't address those problems like the imposter syndrome and all those other issues that might have from the wounded inner child, like other things aren't going to work.
That's right.
You're not solving the core problem.
No. And I did use, so I took the injections. I'm still taking the injections that everyone is using. I personally use tirzepatide, which is under the brand name of Mounjaro. It's similar to Ozempic. It's Ozempic's cousin, and it does a little more than Ozempic does. It's a little newer. And I had gastric bypass. So that is one leg. And I put what I eat, which is I eat a very healthy diet that's full of protein and low fat, low in calories, low in sugar. And I put diet, exercise, my medication, and my surgery all in the same pot. That's one leg of the solution to obesity. That is not going to cover the whole thing. And it is a wonderful, miraculous development in science that we are recognizing obesity as a disease, and there are medications and interventions that can treat the disease. And I think for some people, maybe they'll be successful with just that. But I think for most of us, when the obesity was triggered, like you said, that wounded inner child, I know one of my earliest memories and my first memory of food was my 5th birthday. It was a time where my mom had left me and my little brother with my dad. There were no friends, no presents, no party, no cake. But my dad picked me up from school with a dual pack, the double pack of Hostess cupcakes with the swirly white lines on
them. Oh, yeah. I remember it.
And he said, happy birthday. This is yours. And you don't have to give one of these to your brother. And it sounds like a sad story, but when I tell you, I was thrilled. So by my 5th birthday, food was love, food was comfort, food was everything. Mm-hmm. That is definitely something that I had to figure out, untangle, get to the root of for me to be able to, because I refused to lose a pound on purpose unless I was going to be sure that I had cracked the code and I was going to figure out how to keep it off because I was never going to lose weight and gain it back ever again. So that was really important to me. And that's what I did on my podcast was get with a therapist, even with my children. We talked about what it was like for them growing up in a fat family because they were chubby as children, how I handled their overweight, what it was like for them with me trying to lose weight. And we just don't hear people having these conversations. But I wanted, it took a lot for me to talk them into that. They're young adults, 22 and 24, and they were really vulnerable on the show. Speaking their truth and talking about their weight, in childhood was a tough thing. But I said, we are going to help people. People are going to hear this and they're going to know how to handle their children's weight, you know, in a way that won't scar their children.
Yeah. So, well, that's like an authentic approach, because a lot of people, they put on masks, they do like fad things, they do quick hits, you know, 20 steps and then you're done. And like you said, you need to be able to do something that's sustainable for the rest of your life, right?
That's right.
So the problem with a lot of stuff you see on social media is like, well, I'm going to do this all or nothing process. I'm going to do this 20 step thing and I got to stay on it. But it's like, it doesn't handle all the legs.
No.
So if you don't handle all the legs of everything that's got pillars, right? And so if you don't handle the mental, the mindset pillar, the spirit, the heart, the soul, and those are esoteric. And a lot of times those things are hard to quantize, but science, like you have a holistic approach. There's the scientific stuff you can quantize, you can measure.
You
can see where you're going.
How many calories you eat, how many calories you burn, all that. Measure.
Yeah, but the mental, I mean, there are ways to mental, you know, brain waves and stuff and start to figure out what they mean, but that's not fully mapped out. Everybody's not got that totally defined yet. At some point in the future, maybe they will. But that is a lot of stuff that you have to get beyond, like the belief systems.
Yeah.
Like you have a belief system that I'm a failure. You have a belief system that you're ugly. Yeah, then you're probably never going to succeed, because it's going to be temporary, because you're comfortable with that. So if you're comfortable with that overall thing that you're a failure, I'm always going to be fat, I'm never going to be thin, then your mind controls your body. And until you realize like that there's a lot of control over that, and you have the key, but you got
to
believe.
That's hard
to do unless you get into the process, and you do have to have all the legs. And you have to be in the right position in the right frame of mind, or a lot of the stuff you do, you're going to end up doing it over and over and over.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I was in that cycle for sure. And so that food relationship, the feelings, that's that mind piece that you were talking about. So there's the pillar of the body. There's the pillar of the mind that for me covers that relationship with food, emotional eating, all of this stuff. And another example, like that's really shocking to thin people who listen to the podcast and or who know me, and I was able to open up about it, is that there were a lot of benefits to being 337 pounds. And on the show, that's another thing I really was determined to unearth. What am I gaining from being this size that I'm going to have to let go of consciously in order to maintain a lower body weight? Because in the past, I remember the one time I had lost 80 pounds, I was maybe 20 pounds from finally being under 200 pounds at that time. I think I felt panic. Like I literally panic ate and regained the weight as quickly as possible. Subconsciously, of course, because of course, as it's happening on the surface, I'm devastated. But underneath, there was some real deep need to maintain my plus size status. And so I was determined that, you know, and this is all that mind stuff. Where did this food relationship begin in that baby bottle situation or the fifth birthday? What, you know, what were the benefits to me? Why am I resistant? Like I felt a sense of safety in the world being a larger woman. And now being a smaller woman, I can tell you that was right to feel that. I've had more people touch me more. Like I literally I was at a fancy theater and a man tried to put his hands on me and physically move me. I was utterly shocked. I was like, when I was 337 pounds, men did not come in my personal space, period. Like, period. My daughter and I joke on the podcast, like, you don't have to worry about this man kidnapping you into his van, you know, because definitely it's going to be a two-man job. All I have to do is drop dead weight and you're not getting anywhere with me. I'm going to be able to put up a fight, you know?
Yeah.
So I had to unearth those types of beliefs and look at them. And for different people, it's different. You know, people have a lot of reasons why. Like I literally have lost over 2 feet of girth. And if you imagine personal space boundaries in our culture, it's 18 to 24 inches of personal space between your face and mine. But if you add the extra 2 feet that I had of space around me, my face was further in, I had more. And so there are things like that. That's all that mind piece. Like, what are the things that are supporting my staying this size? Because I'm a smart lady. I've got my doctorate. I'm an overachiever. That was my way of in childhood trying to make my life better was to be perfect at school and make everyone happy, people pleaser, perfectionist, all those things. And so if I really wanted to be thin, I would have figured it out by now, I felt. So I was determined to get underneath all that. And, and if I'm going to do something like that, that's that hard, I wanted other people to benefit from it. I'm like, I'm going to put this on tape and let people listen to me on tape. That ages me. And let people listen, you know.
Well, I think it's important that you, if you have a lesson learned and you're the type of person that can be a teacher, because not everybody has the kind of temperament to be a teacher. They don't have the patience. They don't have the communication skill to actually be able to relay a lesson. Right. Yeah. So if you I've met some professors that probably didn't have as good a skill set at that as others. And, yeah. But if you realize
being that, professionally teacher doesn't mean you're actually good at teaching.
Yeah.
So we all have been there.
Yeah. If you know that you're good at relaying that message, that you'd like to actually lift other people, that you want to take what you've learned and see if you're going to help the greater society, that's a really cool thing to be in, you know, that to be that person that does that. And then when you start to unpack it, you start to realize like there are a lot of people's stories that are individually different, but they're common threads.
Absolutely. I hear from people all the time.
The cookie cutter solutions sometimes try to say everybody's the same. There are commonalities, but being able to actually read an individual and then seeing how to apply solutions at an individual, like microcosm level, understanding the macrocosm of like, yeah, there's general groupings and maybe people fall into these patterns. But it seems interesting. Like once you get into this really kind of mindset work, then you start to realize there's usually not one size doesn't fit all, but there are some common, you know, ideas, logic, you know.
And remembering that in this mindset thing, I used to believe that, because I'm a therapist, so I'm big into the feelings. I think that runs everything. And I used to believe that if I just figured out the food relationship, figured out the feelings, that the weight would just melt away. That it was all my fault, really, because I didn't have my feelings under control and I didn't know how to cope with life stress and all of that. And, you know, that was the real problem. But doing the podcast and exploring this and talking with obesity medicine experts and experiencing getting treatment for my disease of obesity, it's so important, I think, for people and it actually frees people up to explore those feelings and the shame and all the things that they're carrying around that help them to support being in a larger body, maybe if they don't want to. It frees you up to uncover that if you can recognize that it's a disease, that this is a medical issue, and that you can let go of thinking that it's all your fault or that you're going to just fix it by fixing your feelings or your mindset. Like mindset, yes, my mindset has changed drastically, and I'm happy to share some of those things with your audience or anybody that wants to hear about it. But that alone was not going to get me to where I'm at now, which is a BMI of 25. And, you know, I am healthy for the first time in my adult life. And I had to have the mind, the body, and the spirit all on board, getting moving in the same direction. So it's not just a matter of fixing myself. It's also about getting treatment for my disease from doctors. And that is possible. It is out there and more help is coming.
Yeah. And that's part of this,
by the way, but they're testing these medications for use in treatment of all sorts of addiction disorders, alcoholism and others, because people on these medications have reported they're able to stop drinking. You know,
yeah, I was going to go there on addiction because when they go to like the disease part of it, it seems like it'd be a common thread between like gambling, you know, porn addiction, alcoholism, drug addiction. It seems to be like the maybe in the same area in the brain that people are getting caught up in these addictive scenarios or these addictive diseases.
100%.
And once and being a musician, being a creative, part of the problem in the creative world is some people feel they have to be in the addictive cycle to actually create art. And if they get connected to that and then they become successful, is very destructive.
Yes.
Because their livelihood gets tied into their addiction. And then that's like how they earn money. That's how they get. And then they're tied to that. It's like, that's why some, you get the 28 Club, you get the people that pass away because they get too caught up in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get too tied to a very destructive cycle that doesn't have to be that way. It's a mindset. You don't have to be on a downward spiral to be an artist. You actually can, can have a different route. You don't have to go that way.
That's right. And there's maybe that spirit piece that comes into play. I know for me, my creativity and my spirituality are very closely tied together. But yes, it's the reward center of the brain that gets hijacked by addiction. And so for me personally, I know that my reward system goes in overdrive when I eat sugar. I get a lot of good feeling dopamine from cupcakes and donuts and ice cream and all those things. And that's when I'm in active sugar addiction, which I'm not now. And a long period of abstinence puts it away. The problem is, as they say with alcoholics, alcoholics are experts at stopping drinking. The problem is that they don't know how to not start again.
Yeah.
And for me, sugar addiction was the exact same. But what I've learned through my process is that it's not about a one silver bullet solution. It is a day in and day out self-care exercise that requires the medical interventions, the mindset, the new tools for coping with your feelings so that you're not turning to the kitchen. And for me, my spiritual practice, and it can be different for everyone, but some basis in your, whatever your higher power is, or your sacred self, your higher self, whatever it is you put your faith in, there has to be some connectedness to that. I think for me, definitely, to have those three legs of the stool. So I have to have my mindfulness practice, meditation, and just strong sense of belonging to something bigger than myself. You know, super important. That ultimate love that binds us all together.
Yeah, a lot of, like, I'm a Buddhist, and a lot of what we do is like mindfulness and balance.
That's right.
And trying to be in balance with the universe. I practice like a Japanese form of Buddhism that's a lot, it's tied to a lot of concepts in terms of universal balance. And like, you can't always be totally in balance. And yeah. It's like the tool is like, you don't have to go from, like, sometimes the people have a problem where it's gotta be absolute and absolutism. They were human beings. We make mistakes, right? So if you're an absolutist and you say, well, if I have one thing of sugar, I'm just going to stay on the sugar. I'm going to have one, you know, tote of this. It's like, I'm going to stay on it. It's like,
I blew it today. I may as well eat everything. Yeah.
Then it might go to all the way to the extreme. And it's just a matter of being able to kind of right the ship. And, there are waves in the ocean, and that everything's always going to be perfect.
That's right.
I think it's probably with the perfection trap, because a lot of people get into the perfection trap was like, if you're not perfect, why do you need to give it up? Or I can't even do it. And lot of times, like, life is like, you know, it's like, if you're in this kind of process of, I don't know, we call it a flow state. A lot of artists, like, I've gone more into the flow state and trust myself than trying to be absolutely perfect. And if you can realize that the imperfections in art or in life are actually part of your story.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong about learning from those lessons.
Well, and we're human.
We have
to embrace the idea that we are human beings making mistakes, falling off the wagon, so to speak. Not being perfect is baked in. It's like automatic. We can look at that. We don't have to be afraid of that. There's no shame in that. When I do something frustrating, or if I make a mistake, or if maybe I eat something I shouldn't eat, or whatever it might be, I say, oh, that's just my humanity showing. I love myself. I'm just human. It's okay. You know, and we have to let go of that perfection. Perfectionism and people pleasing are the enemy of any kind of progress, growth, because it will hold you back. I mean, and I was a professional people pleaser and perfectionist my whole life. So I totally, that was how I coped.
Yeah.
And that really held me at 337 pounds, because I, you know, food was my way of coping with stress. And mm-hmm. when you're a people-pleasing perfectionist, life can be very stressful. That's and I used to jokingly say that all of my accomplishments were brought to you by Ben and Jerry. because, you know, I was walking around with every single stress I had ever had on my hips and my bottom and my belly because, you know, that's how I coped with everything. So I could just keep going, keep eating, keep going, keep doing the next perfect thing. And when I hit 47 years old, I was like, wait a minute, though. I've been working really hard, like double time, doing everything I'm supposed to do perfectly as much as possible. But life isn't getting better. Like, where's my happy ending? Where's the like gold pot of gold at the end of the perfection rainbow? It just wasn't appearing. Yeah. This is for the birds.
That expectation gap, like you build this kind of idealistic vision, right? Then like that's where a lot of people make mistakes. Like if I run into so many artists, they go to their loft and they got all these paintings. Like, are these in the gallery? Like, no, they're not ready. Mm-hmm. So they're like preventing themselves from actualizing because they don't think they're ever ready. And I've run into the same thing with singer-songwriters, you know, as a producer, like they have all this work. And then they'll show me something like there's a copy of like a Taylor Swift. I'm like, nobody really wants to hear that because she already does it, right? Like, I want to hear the stuff that you're scared to put out because that's actually who you are. That's the vulnerable part of you, but you're scared because like you don't hear that anywhere else because that's your ticket. Your ticket is the fact that that stuff isn't like everybody else, but then you're scared of it. The people who are successful are able to kind of bridge that gap between being vulnerable and actually putting it out. And not that they don't care about the reaction, but they learn how to handle the reaction. Because what usually happens is if you become your authentic self, somebody's going to say they don't like it.
Oh, absolutely.
How you handle that is how you are going to be able to be successful or not.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And it is really scary to be your authentic self. And I think that's, you know, food and my extra 180 pounds extra that I was carrying around really helped protected me from feeling vulnerable. And, you know, it was a fake sense of protection, but I felt protected from it. It also was a little bit like an apology to the world. Like I, you know, felt like I was a pretty girl, you know, pretty enough, like maybe not your, Taylor Swift next door, but you know, attractive enough, you know, and I was really smart and successful and all this stuff. And so I felt like, who am I to be all this and everyone's ideal standard of beauty? If I'm thin and society likes my body, then I will be a threat to women. Men will be afraid to talk to me. Like it was like a weird, very subconscious. I didn't walk around saying I'm so great and I better be fat so that people can find me approachable. But it was definitely something about the safety for me that I felt like it was my ticket to people liking me more.
Yeah, because it's like
I know.
No, it makes a lot of sense because I've run into people like sometimes you're afraid to approach somebody because of their outward appearance. Mm-hmm. And you make assumptions that they're unapproachable.
That's right.
And it's usually a lot about you, that you don't have the confidence to talk to them. And then if you're a person like that, you know, the other side of it is like, well, you know, if I look like Taylor Swift, then I'm going to be in this in danger, right? So I'm going to protect myself.
And as girls, there's these very early messages that we get about beauty. Like I remember distinctly, you know, if there was a new girl at school and she was pretty, she was a snob, you know, the girls would say she was a snob. So, you know, when you're a kid, you can't do much about your appearance, you know, but as an adult, I could surely make sure that I was at least not a threat in that I'm going to be overweight. And so I'll be more palatable and not perceived, you know, you just think about like in movies, the nice, you know, auntie always is big bosomed and she's got the wide hips
and the bigger figure.
Yeah,
in movies.
Like that's how now Ursula and all the enemies are often big, busty women too. So I don't know, whatever it was, my brain picked this vision, I think, to make being in a bigger body just more emotionally safe for me. But
yeah, it is interesting because like we get these roles that get kind of shown to us through, you know, socialization, and like you get these, you know, stereotypes, or you get these archetypes, and you get, okay, well, this, like, if I'm in this kind of role, if I'm in this lane, I'm going to be unapproachable, or if I'm going to, I'm going to be protected. If I don't, you know, I'm not going to get attacked by the Boston Strangler or somebody, because I'm not going to, they're not going to be able to put me in the van, but they can't grab me. So it's a, you give yourself reasons, you give yourself like this kind of like, I don't know. It's like when people get into like the kind of relationship that they can't get out of. Like there's a comfort in being in a codependency.
Well, and that was another thing I had to do. That's a whole nother episode, but I had to overcome codependency as part of my self-love practice and end a very toxic relationship. So I did that too. And don't
but feel you good, like, I was kind of referring to a codependency, like it's like an internal codependency. Mm-hmm. So your internal codependency, like on your addictive behavior,
yeah,
it's just as similar to like the external codependency with a person.
Absolutely.
And if you don't, if you could get, you can get comfortable with that situation and then never get out of the cycle. Yeah. And so like you made the connections to get out of it and start to see it's a multi-pillar, totally like holistic approach that you're going to have to solve it.
And that started with accepting that I'm human and loving myself enough that I could be vulnerable with myself, to be able to look behind the mask of my own self, not even in front of other people, but just like in my quiet moment, say, who am I really? Where are my faults? And to be able to look honestly at my patterns and my history and all of that, because then I made a safe space for myself to explore all of that. And you know, and all of that is totally tied together, you know, setting myself free from food and being overweight and toxic relationships and perfectionism and people pleasing. It was all one big job that was all intertwined. And
so on that road, did you do a lot of like journaling or art therapy? Because like to get that story, like the idea with the poets is like the looking glass self is this Victorian concept that a lot of the poets like Blake and Wordsworth and Longfellow and Tennyson, they all have this idea, like if you start to look at that looking glass self, then that triggers the muse. And then when that triggers the muse, then you start to uncover all this core like material that creates the art. Mm-hmm. And that art is usually stuff that's inside and outside and your connection, and you get like channeled to figure out how to build those connections through your art, to see the internal that's similar to the external, and then come up with the art that kind of speaks to everybody. And then they start to understand the same thing, because we're all human. We're all feeling those things, is that we're able to actually put it into words or put it into music or put it into art.
Yeah, I was one of those people that hated meditating. I hated journaling. As a therapist, I would tell people all the time to meditate, to journal, but I never would do it. I hated it. These are things that I've been able to incorporate into my practice now that I was never able to do before. Mm. My way of uncovering all these things was that the videos that I was making on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. So as I was learning lessons, I was opening up and sharing them online. And that is how I kept things organized and moving forward. And I held myself accountable. Like once I said it out loud on a video, like, oh, this is the tool I'm using, and developing these tools, it was like it became real in my life.
You did video journaling, you know, which actually is still using your creative self.
Absolutely.
To do it, you just found a way that you didn't have to do it in a book, that you did it through like the video.
Totally. And I still really enjoy the creative process of making videos and editing myself into something that's, you know, tied up in a neat little one and a half minute bow for everyone.
That's interesting. So how did you get into the podcast, since we're talking about podcast? Was it just taking from that point and then saying, oh, I need to extend this to a longer form?
Yeah, I had a friend of mine, because none of this was ever in my aspirations, too, by the way. I never ever said, oh, I want to be a content creator. I want to make podcast. Never, ever, never wanted to make TikToks. But, here we are. That's the way of the world. So I was with a friend and I opened up to her and I said, I'm considering having weight loss surgery and I'm considering trying to lose weight. And she was so excited for me. She said, oh, yes, do it, do it, do it. And she said, you need to be making a podcast, because I started telling her all the things that I was thinking about, that sense of safety and all the things I was uncovering. She said, you need to be recording this right now. She put me in touch with someone who became my producer, and that's all she wrote.
Wow. Then you got right
Yeah.
into it.
I want you said something that made me want to point something out for your audience, and that is that you so talked about being creators being authentic, their authentic selves, and being vulnerable and putting out there in their art who they really are. And I wanted to say that when that process is in alignment with that higher self, that inner gut calling, when you feel a calling, like I always felt called to paint. So I took what part of my self-love practice was going down that road. I took painting classes, and this is something that I foster in my life now. If there is an inner nudge that you're ignoring because you think you can't do it, or because you think you're not good enough, that your job in this life is that tiny little flame of that nudge to
That's
nurture
true.
that into a fire. Like that is all, that is it. That is the end of the story. You are here to love, to create love, to expand love. And you're going to do that by following those inner nudges. And I don't care how big and ridiculous it might sound, if it's something you've been dreaming of, that is your job in this life. I promise. There's never a time where that's not true. And now that does not mean that if your nudge is to make music, that you are destined to be Taylor Swift
Yeah,
or a pop
there.
star. No, no,
It
no.
might not
Because
be, yeah.
you never know who you're touching with your art. And it might be your part in this universe might not be something you ever are able to see clearly until the end. But I promise you, those nudges, like this whole thing started for me because I felt a nudge, a calling to host a women's retreat. That's truly the beginning of this. And I said, well, what in the world would I talk about at a women's retreat? So I started asking my friends, what do you want to talk about? And the inner critic came forward as the message that I was supposed to talk about. So I had to set about learning about the inner critic. And I had no idea. I'm like, I'm 337 pounds. I don't have an inner critic. So I started researching. And that led me down the road of discovering how to quiet the inner critic, how to invite self-love, being honest with myself, losing weight, the mind, body, spirit thing. It opened every door to where I'm at right now, was that little tiny flicker of a tiny little flame saying, women's retreat, you're supposed to host that. Like, what? Like, I'm not an expert at anything. But I followed the steps. I took steps in that direction, and the universe provided for me and guided me and showed me the next step every single turn. So whatever those nudges are, we have to be following them.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in that, because a lot of times, if you're a creative person, you kind of take that muse and you go with it. And sometimes you don't know where it's coming from. And like I said, the muse is not always this external thing. It's like, it's basically, I think a lot of creative people, we're in tune with the inner and the outer. And some people want to think it's the outer muse that's always doing it, but it's like, it's their subconscious. It's like, a lot of people, when you're an artist, you're in a dream state, like a waking dream, and you have your actual dreams, and you're able to connect until you get to this kind of flow state. In that flow state, it seems like it's coming from, like, you don't know where, but it's the internal subconscious stuff. It's the external, something that just happened today, somebody triggered a memory. There's a lot of things. It's hard to define, but I think a lot of
I
creative
call that,
people, they can kind of go with it. They go with it at the time they feel
yeah, and
it.
that's where courage comes in. Creative people are courageous, and following that inner voice and going with that flow state and letting go of control and letting go of the conscious ego mind thinking it is going to tell everything how it's going to go, that takes courage. And that is where creatives, you'll find the most courage, I think, for sure. And that, I call it channeling. For me, that flow state happens a lot when I'm a guest on podcasts, when I'm teaching in a retreat, when I'm recording my podcast, when I'm recording videos. I don't know where these perfect words are coming from that are going to connect, like that are this like, oh, this is the lesson. Yes. Amen. That was great. I don't take credit, because that's me channeling the universal, whatever this beyond is. And that might sound weird to people, but when you know it, you know, when God or whatever you call God is coming through in your art or your words or your parenting or your relationship with someone or your work that you do every day, God is coming through that if you're doing it right. And it's a beautiful thing when you can put your finger on it when it's happening and you say, oh, this is wonderful flow state. This is magic that's happening right now.
Yeah, that doesn't just have to happen for creators. You know, like a lot of times I try to tell people, like a lot of business people will say they're not artists. And when I talk to them, it's like, well, you are. Mm-hmm. Like you are creative. Like every human being, no matter what they're doing, is actually tapping into that, whether they want to admit it or understand what they're tapping into. When they start to fully understand that, you know, it's not just for Wordsworth, it's not for Tennyson, it's not just for Shakespeare, it's for everybody. Yeah. Everybody can do it no matter what you do. Like athletes tap into it, you know, dancers tap into it, you know, public speakers tap into it, everybody taps into it.
So I'm curious, for me, when I get into that flow state, when I know that God is coming through in my words or my connection to another person, it's energizing. It feels like almost like you've stepped into some Nike, you know, wingtips and you're floating on air a little bit. There's just like this lightness. It feels, it's almost like there's someone standing, like my little inner cheerleader is going, yes, 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 go, fly.
In that zone.
In that zone. So what does it feel like for you?
Well, as a musician, I'm a keyboardist. And if I get into a flow state, and I'm a keyboard, I got like stacks behind me.
Okay.
And what happens is like when you get into that groove, whether I'm by myself or with a band, it is somehow like you just know what to do. If you go film it, and I film some of my performances, like I don't, like if somebody asks, like, what did you feel at that moment? It's like, I don't really know. I was in the zone. It's like I'm channeling.
Yeah.
Like a lot of what happens with a musician is like I'm pulling stuff that I heard maybe 20 years ago or maybe 5 minutes ago. I'm looking at what's happening in the crowd or looking at what's happening with the members of my band. And it's all kind of happening all at once. Mm-hmm. And over time, because you trust yourself as a musician, you don't think about like what the next note is. You just kind of go with where the energy or frequency in the room tells you to go. And like, if you're in this kind of trance. And I've talked to a lot of you probably can see it when you see a lead guitar player playing that solo and they look like they're really kind of like, what are they doing? It's like, they're in that zone.
Yeah.
You know, if you see any musician, like a sax player or the P, anybody that's in that kind of zone, you're like, it's not that they're reading the sheet music. Like it's the music is in them. They are the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so funny because when I do this as a therapist and a coach with my clients, like there'll be some things like, imagine it's got to be the same as a musician. Like you could probably describe to me scenarios where you'd be like your worst nightmare musically. And you're going, your ego mind says, oh crap. Like what's going to happen now? And that like, if a client says a certain thing, I'll be like, oh, I don't know what to say. And then I open my mouth and the magic comes out, you know, like just somehow I knew and they say, oh my gosh, that's the, you know, the greatest thing. And that's when I know that it's beyond me. It's just beyond me. And it just, for me, it's confirmation that I'm in the right place, doing the right thing at the right time. I've opened myself up. And, you know, a friend of mine, he said, you gave your life to God a long time ago. And he uses that terminology, God, where I might say the universe. But I think what he meant by that was that I'm courageous enough to step aside, to put that ego mind, the worries, the fear, whatever's going on in my little brain, my human brain aside, and let that force of creativity and connection come through me.
Yeah, you kind of got to get out of your own way.
Yeah.
Because the enemy, like this, I kind of run into with like classical musicians. Sometimes like they're so used to reading the sheet that if you put them into a jazz fusion band, then they kind of like, well, I don't really know where to go.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we might have a general sheet, but then we'll go off somewhere that's not written down.
Yeah.
And then they don't trust themselves enough to go there. They're looking for you like, well, where, what's the chord chart? What's the next change? What's, you're like, no, just listen. Right. And some of these guys, they either can get it and start to feel it. And other ones, it's like, I can't really get it because I'm looking for something that's kind of preordained or pre-written, and they can't feel the moment. And you're like, right. But you're technically just as good as I am as a musician, but you're used to having a plan. You're used to having somebody tell you what the words are. It's like a method actor. They could have the script, but they can go off. And they actually absorb the character. And I said, well, you know, the character is really going to say this. And they tell the director, like, I'm going to say this because I think this character, this is what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And it'll go off script and do something better than what the writers wrote.
That's right.
Because they actually got into it.
And it's the same for therapists, by the way, because about probably at least half of people who are therapists are by the book therapists. And I'll tell you what they teach in therapy school. Basically, you're not supposed to give advice. You're not supposed to interpret really. You're supposed to help lead a client to discover these things for themselves. What that leads to is a lot of people who want to help others and they become therapists, but that's not their calling. And they do this. Oh, and how does that make you feel? And what do you think about that? And there's no inspiration. There's no, you know, they're not letting go. They're following the book. And I did all that. I did learn those things, but I'm not that kind of therapist or coach. Like, I am a totally different kind of therapist and coach. We're going to really make change here because I open the doors and let the universe guide the process. Yeah. It is. And when a person, you know, is ready for change and they meet a therapist like that, there's going to be some magic and it's going to sometimes hurt.
Oh yeah. Well, that's the thing is, like, things that go forward are not always easy and not always not painless.
And this is why The Easy Way Out is the name of my podcast. It's The Easy Way Out, WEIGH. And I truly, like, all of this has been the hardest thing I've ever done, but also the most wonderful, joyful, rewarding thing I've ever done in my life. Like, really undertaking self-love. And I'm still a student of it. I've still got far to go. I'm going to India to stay in an ashram in, I'm leaving on April, sometime in April, just a couple of weeks from now. So I am a student forever, a perpetual student. And that's, I still have a lot to learn. Yes. And a lot to learn about taking care of my body. You know, this is a lifelong journey. And I only know what it's like to lose 180 pounds and take care of my body at 49 years old. Like, I don't know what it's going to be like to take care of my body at 65 years old. And
You said, it's like a learning thing. They did, like a lot of times the people, they want to think like, okay, well, when do I stop? Right. Because I expected I was going to get this like certificate and it's going to be in this position. And then everything's going to be like, given to me, and it's going to be, I'm going to see the path, I'm going to get there.
Yeah.
And then
for me, that was reaching a size 10. I thought if I could reach a size 10, that's it. The end of the journey, finish line. I won the marathon. Yay me. But the thing is, first of all, now I'm a size 6, which I never imagined, but the thing is, it doesn't stop. It's always evolving. I have to wake up tomorrow and decide that I am going to eat enough protein, that I am going to go ahead and go to my weight trainer, that I'm going to take my walk in the evening. Like, I have to get up every single day for the rest of my life and choose this life for myself and build this life, because it really is, you are building a life. Is it the one that you want is the question. How are your daily habits? Are they creating the life that you dream for yourself? And I was not. I was creating a way, but I was not building the life that was going to set me up for success and happiness and peace. Like, I've been having, I'm an anxious person by nature. So the last few days, I'm about to travel. I'm going out of the country with my son. I've got some financial anxiety, some travel anxiety. And like, does that mean that I'm terrible at mindfulness? No, it actually means, like, these are the times when I'm leaning on it the most and where I'm learning the most. I'm saying, okay, here I am. I need to go to sleep right now, but I'm consumed with worry about this or that. So how can I apply the tools? And because my human brain is suffering, so how can I apply that mindfulness? How can I use those emotional skills that I've learned to soothe myself, to get myself into a peaceful state where I can sleep and set aside these ego-based worries? Like, that is the practice. Am I never going to worry? No. Am I always going to be happy and feeling great? No, absolutely not. It's just like people are afraid to meditate because they say, oh, I think too much. Like, how am I supposed to not think? Like, no, absolutely not. Actually, the practice of meditation is what you do with those thoughts when they come.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that you're going to be free of thoughts unless you're like Jesus, Buddha, you know, maybe they get free of thoughts sometimes. Like Eckhart Tolle, I suspect, has some freedom from thoughts sometimes. But we're humans. We think like our brains just want to do that. So the practice of meditation is like volleying those thoughts. Like, oh, another thought. Off you go. Oh, another thought. Off you go.
It's so how you handle it.
How you handle it. It's so like, I've been very anxious for days, but it's how I'm handling it. Am I reaching for cake and ice cream before I go to sleep to soothe that anxiety? No, I'm not. Am I reaching for sleep medication to soothe that anxiety? No, I am not. I am using visualization techniques, focusing on my breath, giving myself love and compassion. And that's the deal.
Yeah. Once you find these other techniques that don't like put you in a bad or state, because a lot of times, you know, Western mindset is like, well, I take one pill and then I need another pill for that pill, another pill for that pill. And it just cascades and it's not really solving it.
Yep.
You know, so what you have to do is try to find a way to get rid of the noise. Like there's a lot of noise that happens. And I think meditation is a skill set to kind of, not that all the noise is gone, but you find a ways to manage it so that these kind of disparate or, you know, weird dissonant thoughts or things that kind of just keep on preying on your mind, you find ways to address it so you can get to a more peaceful state, or at least more, you're more in tune with the universe. And that, because it's like a balance, you're not always going to be fully in tune and you have to work on it. It's like this pendulum going from one way to the other. It's always going to be like that until you get to the next form. So you're always going to have to adjust that.
Because the nature of being human is that you're always out of balance. And the practice is like, think when you say that, like picture if I were to put you on a tightrope and you're literally trying to balance. Is there ever going to be a time where you're in perfect balance and you are not at risk for falling off that tightrope?
Not really.
No. The whole point is that while you're on that tightrope, you better be focusing on balance, because you're not in balance. Just by nature of being human, our bodies are not perfectly balanced on a tightrope, right? Like that's not our natural state. So when you're on that, you have to be thinking, you have to be adjusting and moving and holding that balance. If you go to yoga class and you're doing tree pose, balancing is a practice. You got to work at it. Like, you know, it's the same in our lives. So things are coming and going. So like right now, my house is a little bit out of order, but you know, I've got this trip coming up. So there's, you know, things are going to be great over here. Not so great. That's just the juggling act of being human. So expecting perfection is the trap. It's the trap. And the same, all of this goes for losing weight and taking care of your body. It's truly the key to everything, including that. Plus medical treatment for obesity.
But I think it's really awesome that you've kind of got to the point in your life where you figured out that it's not going to be this fad diet or this like 20 step this or this particular book that's going to solve it, that it's a holistic solution that used like modern medicine along with spirituality and meditation. It's like it's a expansive thing. Yeah. And that's sometimes to some people, well, that's too big. Well, you know, life sometimes like you got to maybe take bite-sized stabs at it.
That's right.
And not try to do it all at once. But a lot of things take more work than maybe you're prepared to do at the time because you want to just solve it.
I lost 100 pounds before I had gastric bypass. So I was not exercising at first. I did this one baby step at a time. And truly that is how it's going to unfold for the rest of my life. Like I, instead of thinking, what is my goal weight? What is skinny or acceptable for my body, for me? What's the end goal? The end goal is to be alive when I'm 90 and be able to move around and pick up my grandbabies. Like that's for me, the end goal. The end goal is at death, where, what has been my quality of life? The end goal doesn't have anything to do with my butt size, you know, or whatever. So when you are doing that, like I've made this shift to thinking, instead of what is my goal weight, I want to say, well, what kind of person do I want to be? What I want to be the kind of person that goes to yoga on Wednesdays, that goes to the weight trainer on Tuesdays, that goes to Orange Theory twice a week, that walks my dog, that eats healthy, that enjoys life, that has a body that's able to move around and not in pain. That's the kind of person I want to be. That's the kind of life I want to have. And so every single day I have to make a ton of tiny decisions that build that life.
Yeah, I think that's a holistic picture, because a lot of times, like, if you just say, well, I just want to be able to fit in this dress or fit in this suit or go to this party to show that I'm this and that, and then later let yourself go. The whole point to me is, like, you know, I'm a type 2 diabetic, and like I have to stay in an A1C so that I'm still here, right? Yeah. That I can enjoy my grandkids, that I can enjoy the future, that I can retire. But if I don't pay attention to that, right, I'm not going to be here.
And so, that is made up by a million tiny decisions every day.
Yeah, not you have to make a decision to like, if you don't keep your A1C over time, you're not going to be here, because you're going to stroke out. You're going to, you know, you're going to, you know, get dialysis. You're going to go into all these bad outcomes if you don't take it serious. Yeah. And there's a lot of people, you know, they get diagnosed with something like that and they don't take it serious. And so you have to understand, like, where you are. And, you know, whether you have a disease or not, like in I have, you know, the type 2 diabetes is just as real as any addiction or any other disease. Mm-hmm. But like, you have to understand where you are and address it. You know, I had a father, he didn't really pay attention to his diabetes. I had a grandpa, didn't pay it or not here. Oh, yeah. So like, if you don't pay attention, that's what happens.
Well, and obesity and diabetes are closely related.
Yeah, I got a lesson. I got lessons from my grandpa and my pop.
Yeah, like and you feel that loss, and you know you don't want to continue. You don't want to grow that pain. Like I said earlier, our job is to expand love. You don't want to expand the pain of that by making your grandchildren lose their grandpa. You know, you want to stop that cycle, and you want to end that pain. Like, let's start a new thing where you're teaching your grandchildren to take care of themselves, to manage their health conditions, you know, that you're totally flipping the script in your family history. Not to say that, and again, we want to release shame and let go of shame and blame around health, right? Because we're human and our bodies need a lot of management. It's really hard. Our food supply chain is totally built to make us addicted and unhealthy. Oh, yeah. And so it wasn't your dad and your grandpa's fault. Also,
yeah, they didn't understand it, and they didn't take it serious, and they didn't really know how much they needed to participate.
No, and they probably didn't have access to the healthcare that they deserved.
Yeah, they probably didn't. Needed. You know, I know my grandpa didn't. He didn't really understand, you know, what he was eating and the connection.
Right.
My pop might have understood, but he was kind of tied to patterns from grandpa.
Yep.
And later in life, he tried to reverse it, but he kind of gone too long. Yeah. So, I mean, it's like sometimes you get put on a track and you try to do what you can to minimize it, but you didn't realize you're on the track until you did it too late. So a lot of times you find out where you are, you try to do what you can, you know, but, you know, you just got to at least be involved in your own life.
Yes. Take control of that health. Be willing to look at those numbers. Like, I know for years I would avoid any kind of blood work because I didn't want to hear that I was diabetic and that I was going to have to give up sugar. But this is an important thing too. I, every day at least once, think about, I picture 337 pound Joy, and I send her love and gratitude. I think about the courageous, like the courage that I had to have at 337 pounds to say, what are my health numbers? Can I attempt weight loss again? Can I risk the heartbreak of losing weight and gain it again to try one more time to take control of my life and my health? Like, that took so much courage. And I, as a therapist and coach, when I work with people, we often identify the trouble spots in their lives. And I say, listen, like, let's identify the trouble spots fear-free. Just because we might identify that your marriage isn't so great, that doesn't mean that I'm going to be pushing you off to a divorce lawyer next Tuesday. Like, we can take this one step at a time. You have to free yourself of the worry over the outcome to look at the problems, like to get those blood sugar numbers, to assess honestly where your marriage is without worry about what the outcome is going to be. And then you take it one step at a time to make the little shifts and corrections in your life, as big or as little as you want to do. You know, like having gastric bypass is a pretty extreme decision. That was a big leap, but I, like I said, lost 100 pounds before that. So it was baby steps, you know? And I think it's the same for any of these things that we dream for ourselves, any of those nudges that we're feeling, to take those by the horns, you have to be able to let go of that attachment to the outcome.
Yeah, that's really, really important. Mm-hmm. I like the way you approach things. Like, you're looking at Ozempic, you're looking at things like that, you know, looking at drugs like that, you're looking at the bypass, you're looking at mindfulness, spirituality, diet, exercise, you know, and just, you know, meditation. A lot of times people will just do one part of that. Like we've talked about, they take one pillar and they think it's going to solve it. Maybe outwardly it looks like it does, but like overall, then it doesn't, because you go right back into the pattern because you haven't solved the core pillar. And it's really like we've been talking about balance. I mean, oh, that's foo-foo, but like balance is very important. It's that everybody's on that tightrope.
When I promise you, if you have obesity for, if you've had obesity for any significant amount of time and you are significantly overweight and you've managed to lose the weight without all three of those things, the mind, body, the spirit, the pillars, it's, you know, at least the emotional part and the mind part have to come with it. You are going to have transfer addiction. So you are not going to walk out of that and be like, ah, all of a sudden I don't need ice cream to survive life anymore. Like, what you gonna do? You know, so you're going to be over shopping. You're going to be gambling. You're going to be using sex. You're going to be using alcohol or other drugs. You're going to be doing something, I promise. And because I deal with those temptations all the time. Shopping is a major one for me, and scrolling, you know, these are things I have to rein in and say, what's going on here? Why do you feel like you need another pair of pants? You know,
that's really interesting, because we talked about addiction. You get this transference from one thing to the next.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You know,
you stop smoking and then you do something else. Somebody stops smoking, but they didn't really get rid of the core why they were smoking. So then they get into, you know, shopping, or they get into something else, or, and they're stuck on some other thing.
That's right. It's very common for people after bariatric surgery to die from alcoholism. It's quite devastating, actually. Alcoholism after bariatric surgery is a very high risk. So if you go into it without investigating the emotional part, you are putting yourself in major risk for a deadly, an even deadlier disease, because you've lost, your body has lost the ability to process alcohol in the same way. So the disease of alcoholism will progress extremely fast after bariatric surgery. So yes, when you start drinking too much, you are going to get to that like liver disease and the deadly parts of alcoholism much faster than another person who maybe has been drinking forever, but they still have their stomach intact. So that's something for people to think about. Real risk.
I think it's just the balance and being able to understand it's not just one issue. Usually there's multiple issues all tangled together. And you have to kind of look at it as a long-term, lifelong, something that you're going to have to be able to manage it. And so if you do, if you, your solution is something that you can't actually maintain for like more than 6 months, then that's probably not going to be a lifelong solution.
Right. That's right. I don't have, there's no food that is against my, like, I don't, there's nothing that is banned from my diet. I don't eat beef and pork, but that has nothing to do with weight loss.
But if you have to find a way to be like not so crazy on one extreme or the other, because you're probably going to easily go back to, well, I'm never going to eat this again.
And I have to be very careful about like sugar is my thing, right? I never had a problem with chips or salty things. It was always the sugar. And so I do allow myself to eat those things, but in very small amounts.
Moderation,
and under certain circumstances. For example, if I ate a chocolate chip cookie at a fair on Sunday, yesterday, And I ate it slowly. I really took tiny bites. I really enjoyed it. I actually enjoy food way more now because I take my time. Yeah. Yes. Before it was almost like a contest, like how much of this can I eat, how fast?
You eat the whole batch.
You're like, who ate that? I didn't even experience those cookies just now. So anyway,
Yeah, it's like a thing with a diabetic. We go out, and not that I can't go to a restaurant, but I have to have portion control, whether or not they give me portion control. And I know I can't eat that whole plate.
That's right.
So I know I have to eat like quarter of the plate or half of the plate or like not even eat, not eat this and ask for more veggies.
Yep.
And so like you, it's not that you can't do something. You have to maybe do it differently than everybody else. So you can still participate. And people are like the all or nothing mindset. Well, I can't even go there.
No.
But you could.
The fastest way to drive me to the Krispy Kreme is to tell me that I can never eat another donut. If you tell me I can never eat another donut, I will be at the Krispy Kreme so fast your head will spin. I mean, I just can't live like that. I do this cool thing. I found a nutritionist on Instagram. I can't remember her name, but she calls it nutrition by addition. You eat what you want and add what you need. So if I was desperately craving a donut, which when you limit the amount of sugar you eat, the cravings go way low. But if I was craving a donut, I might have a donut, but I'm going to put some fiber, high fiber food, high protein food to balance that out. And I'm going to eat it slowly and savor it. So I never, you know, if I want a cookie, I'm going to eat a cookie, but I'm going to eat some, you know, high protein, you know, turkey and some cheese, you know, get some good fruit in some watermelon with it. And then it's a whole experience that's going to be satisfying instead of eating a whole sleeve of Oreos. You know, an Oreo might be a part of this meal.
Yeah, I think that's a really good approach, and it's balanced, and it's incremental, and it's doable.
Yes.
And so that's where people who, well, this is too hard because they don't know where to start. But again, I think I want to make sure that everybody clicks on your podcast to watch it.
Yeah.
And so that will be fully clickable. We got a little bit over our hour, but if we're having such a good conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have to close it now. But I do encourage everybody to check out The Easy Way Out. And we do have the link there and on Apple Podcast. And I do thank you for being a guest on the program. I think what we said today is going to help a lot of people that have been struggling with any type of addiction because it applies to a lot of things, but specifically with weight loss. I think it's very important that, you know, people check this out and share it with their friends. And I, again, thank you for being a guest on the Fam Electricos podcast.
Thank you.